Hey, everybody, it's Tommy Canale, and welcome back to Before the Lights podcast, the show that tells you how they made their mark. Today, we're going to talk about food, film, and possibly jewelry. She has worked for almost 30 years as a food and prop stylist, which includes commercials, print, cable programming, and web broadcast. Her client list is extensive. It includes Purina, McDonald's, Buffalo Wild Wings, and even Jennie-O Turkey. She's the president emeritus of Minnesota Women in Film and Television. Let's welcome in Jody Lichtor. Jody, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you, Tommy. Nice to be here.
Originally from Kansas, is that correct?
I grew up in Kansas City, but I lived summers in Eau Claire, Wisconsin with my grandparents.
But you started as a ballet dancer at age 4 and studied with master teachers in New York City and Kansas City, and even danced in the Kansas City Ballet in the 70s. Was this the first career outlook for you?
No, actually not. I grew up on a cusp, but my family were all medical doctors. And I grew up on the cusp of where women really didn't do anything other than most women, I should say, would go into nursing, librarian, teaching, whatever. And so it was automatically assumed I'd go into nursing until my father, who worked across the hall from a very generous dentist, said, "Joe, I think, what about dental hygiene for Jody? Because the hours are better and the pay is better and so forth." So I found myself switching my, during my prerequisites, switching over to dental hygiene and going into dental hygiene, which was something that I had to learn to embrace.
Are you still doing that today?
I am. Initially, I've tried to get out of it many times. When I moved to New York City, I went back to school in graphic design and computer graphics, and came back to the Twin Cities, purchased a diet and exercise business with a friend of mine, which I ran for 3 years. He did the part around the diet, which he had researched. And then I just decided I needed to find something that was more creative because I am not your typical hygienist. Freelance for many, many years as a hygienist and do temporary. I was the first temporary hygienist in the Twin Cities in the late 70s when I first moved here. And then eventually decided that I would try my hand in film and television. First commercial was with Sears Shoes, did some wardrobe styling. And eventually I was called by one of the producers to do an infomercial for KTEL for Ron Popeil's Rotisserie 2000. They knew I could cook, and he gave me the most extensive shopping list I've ever had. It took me 3 days to do it because there were two talking heads and five rotisseries going at the same time, which had to be filled with all types of food, including trout and duck and all these things. So after I did that, I sort of opened the door for people to call me and decided then at that point to stop doing feature films and not stop doing commercials, but mostly do food styling and props.
All right. Let me back up just a little bit. As a child, then, were you creative as a child?
Always. Yes.
Were you like making things, or tell me some like examples of what you would do?
Well, I was always drawing. I would take art classes. I took dance for a long time. I played piano. I always sang in the choir in school, and my parents felt that the arts were not a career. They were something to do as a side hustle, so to speak. And so at that point, I just kind of went off into hygiene. And during hygiene, I did not dance. But once I finished, I would do a day of work, and then I would go take a company class or rehearsal and dance at night. So it just was, I just needed to have that balance in my life.
When I say the word beautification, what does that mean to you?
It means, for me specifically, it's about creating my own reality, creating and appreciating the beauty around me. And that has become almost involuntary. My latest obsession in the last number of years has become garbage. I cannot stand the fact that there is so much trash and garbage around, which there never used to be in Minneapolis. And I have a plan for this that I'm trying to pursue on a couple of different levels.
The reason I asked the question about beautification is when I was doing some research, I saw that you are involved or were in modeling of aging but dangerous women that were 50 to 79 years old. And I thought, wow, this is a beautiful thing. That's why I asked the question about beautification. So tell me about this. Is this still something going on?
So years ago, Jean Ketchum, who started Aging But Dangerous with her partner, Suzanne, used me and other friends to sort of build the model for what they were looking for. And they model in a sense of, you know, their prototype of what this was for women. Bringing women to the forefront over 50 who were willing to take a risk and just go out there and be the most they could be. That time, and I can't remember the first year we did this, they decided to do a fashion show and they chose, I think there were 12 of us initially who walked the runway wearing Merchant's high-end clothing. The first one, we were 500 people, and it was a benefit for Haiti after the hurricane and so forth. It was a lot of fun. The oldest model was 83, I think, and I was in my mid-50s at the time. Then we did one for Dress for Success. We did that one, and then things just started to get really busy. It was expensive to put the show on. And so Jean just sort of put us to the side, or said, we'll do more. And then COVID happened. And so I'm still involved with the group. I try to still participate in events and so forth, but I've got a lot of other things going on. So not as much as I used to.
Understand. Let's transition into the food. 2006, you worked as an in-house producer prepping recipes for Foodworks Incorporated with Andrew Zimmerman. What did that do for you in being a food and prop stylist?
Andrew at the time had a radio show, did a radio show and did a couple of spots during the week for Fox TV where he would present recipes or he'd go on site, some restaurant or something. And I didn't know him, but I really liked what he did. And I decided to approach him and see if he was looking for an in-house producer and stylist. He wasn't happy with the person that he had on staff and just fired her and hired me on the spot. It was, he had just started the idea of Bizarre Foods that hadn't actually come into fruition quite yet. And so a lot of it was making certain that he was prepped for the TV shows, that I would get all of the food and recipe and things together for him. I would interface with the producers for Fox 9 and also any other people that he was interviewing or in some way promoting in terms of cooking, because he was a chef and was trained as a chef and came to Minneapolis and at one time owned a restaurant. It was not what I had hoped it would be, meaning I really wasn't doing the food styling that I thought I would be. I was really doing more assisting in terms of his business. And I was offered another full-time job about 6 months into that and took that job in a very odd way for a nonprofit doing special events for a short period of time. And then decided I needed to just go back into the freelance of production. I also, for 15 years, was part of Minnesota Women in Film and Television, which is the local chapter for the international group. There's 60 odd chapters around the world. I was their communications person. I did the newsletters. I was their vice president for a couple of years. And then I became president for 3 years until COVID happened. Mm. And we had just voted in a couple more new people into the board. Many of us were on for many years. And they and then I stuck with it. It was hard to do it with an only online Zoom meetings with new members and people who hadn't actually served on a board before. So the next year, my term was up and I stepped away a bit, but I'm still involved with the U.S. group, which was formed as a support group for about 26, 28 chapters throughout the U.S.
Jody, how did you want to get into, or what pushed you to become a food and prop stylist?
Well, I got into the film business. I had a date with this guy who was in the film business, but also in the music business, which have been involved with other people in the music business, quite renowned people in the music business. And so I went out with him and we were chatting. I was just saying, you know, I just have to figure out something. So he said, well, maybe you should get in touch with this production company and this production company and just tell them you're looking to get into the film business and see what they can do. Well, one woman producer was wonderful. And she said to me, you know, I can't really put you in a production assistant role. You have too much experience. So she assigned me as assistant wardrobe on a Sears shoes ad. And then from there, I started working as celebrity caretakers, for instance, LaWanda Page, who was in Red Fox's TV show as Aunt Esther, did a commercial with Church's Chicken. So I was her handler. I also cooked for her. And things did a few feature films. And kind of was putting myself out there as food, or as props and wardrobe and whatever I could do on the corporate end. I did some very high-end corporate shoots as well. And as I said, when I did the Ron Popeil infomercial, I just started getting all these calls and thought, well, I don't want to compete with my really wonderful friends who are so skilled as wardrobe stylists. And so I just thought, I'm getting the calls. I'm just going to be exclusive to that.
And this opportunity came, so you took it and got into food and prop stylist. Is that correct?
Well, I was open to whatever came out. I did a little bit of coordinating for some commercials, but it was not my forte. Feature films. I did a couple of feature films. One that was, did not get the press it should have, with the stars that were involved. And I was assistant to the producer. So I was just kind of feeling out what my next step would be. And because I cook and because I'm so into the aesthetics of food and design, that seemed like the natural pathway to go.
I'm intrigued by this, and I'm sure my listeners will be as well, but what is the tricks to shooting food for commercials and things we see on TV?
Well, it's sort of twofold. So I was trying to find a picture of Matt Burke, who was one of the Vikings players. We did a Got Milk commercial with him and part of that series. And we just used yogurt. Mm. So, if it's a product shot, if it's something that is representative of a product, it has to be exactly as the consumer would receive it. So I did a holiday station. I don't know if you have them in Vegas, but I did a holiday station. It's like the McMuffin, the Egg McMuffin, except it's their egg sandwich. And literally, you know, we were given those sandwiches. They were wrapped a certain way when they were opened. They had to look a certain way. Something more detailed in terms of something less product oriented was Purina. Purina was a great job. And I originally got called because they did not use a food stylist for a shoot in LA that was called Hugs and Stars. It was Beneful Snacks for Dogs. So they decided to reshoot the animation piece of it. So I was asked the first time, I was asked to just get these two different products, buy a whole bunch of boxes and pick out the hero, which is the one that looks perfect on camera. There was no hero. I couldn't find, because the client wanted them to look exactly as they did on the box, which was really beautiful little treats. So what I did was I opened up a whole bunch. I found the one that was most like what I thought they were looking for. I took my Dremel drill. I drilled a hole and extracted, and with dental instruments, extracted the little bits of, I think it was bacon and cheese, from one. And then I would glue back in and populate the star, as it was called, for that one. And then for the other was Hugs. And it was like a little like cannoli with fake meat in it. And so I just extracted some of the meat from another cannoli, per se, another Hug, shoved it inside, just made it look as presentable as possible. And that was the first one, which was ended up being the easiest. The second one, we had to take chicken breast, flash freeze them, and put them on a drill bit so they spun around, and then they were going to fall into and become kibble in a bowl. So I needed to do soy beans, and I did the chicken breasts. The chicken breasts, I thought, might have been the more complicated thing because they were afraid they would flop around. But the soybeans were the hardest. But the final shoot, and unfortunately, the agency that had this client lost it to a Chicago client. The third one was a claymation, and this was for South American distribution. And this was taking ingredients that were in the Benefil and putting them or claymating them. So there was a woman, or claymation, that she would turn them. So I had to get, in January, I had to source corn on the cob with the husk, Savoy spinach, carrots with their tops on them, and one other thing. Well, I was able to luckily find the corn on the cob, which was because it came from Mexico to Minneapolis. And then the art director said to me, well, I want it to look exactly like the box, which was the husk was cut. There wasn't any of the hair on the husk. And so she looked through all the corn and she goes, I don't like any of the corn on the cob. So I took out my instruments and I created the best looking, you know, I extracted kernels and then I would put little nails in. And anyway, so I created the perfect hero for the cob. But I told her that we have to take the cob out and then put it in the husk the way she wants it, because if I pin it and it does the rotation through the animation or the claymation, you're going to see the pin or whatever else is holding in it. So we did it her way. And then, of course, we did it my way, which was the right way. And then she also said something like, you know, I don't like all the hair on the, or I don't like all the distance between where the top of the corn meets the, or top, sorry, top of the carrot greens meet the top. So she said, I want it shorter. So I dug a hole in the, you know, I dremeled and then glued it in, you know, whatever. So it's kind of like being MacGyver sometimes. There are also just beauty shots where I have more free reign for a cub commercial on a, they did, we did one, which was the Vikings tailgating. And I had this big grill that I was supposed to actually partially grill hamburgers for. And then they were going to use some smoke. And then they decided last minute we were going to actually cook it. So, you know, all the marks, I was putting on all the grill marks and I was doing however it would look best on the thing. So that is considered more of a beauty shot. It wasn't in promoting any particular meat or so forth.
What kind of props are used to resemble actual food?
I use real food. I did a Christmas catalog for Schwann's many years ago. There were two shooters, two photographers, and there were two stylists. And this particular division of Schwann's has frozen, it was called Impromptu Gourmet. And they send to the consumer the dish that all it has to do is be cooked. So everything is prepared. And so this particular shoot was to show what it would look like when we were done. It went once we were shooting it. I was not allowed to use anything out of the ordinary that was not represented in the product that they opened and received. However, they did let me go outside and pull some weeds from the cement parking lot and use them for garnish. But in terms of, you know, ice cream is a little bit more complicated. It's usually Crisco or some other inedible product. We use floats, something to hold up. Say I've got a little crisp floating in tomato soup. You know, we base it so that we can set it on something and then just the top of the soup will skim. For beer, if you blow in a straw, you can make the head on the beer. Same with Pepsi. I did a Pepsi commercial. All I had to do was deal with the Pepsi in the glass with the ice. Sometimes we use ice that isn't real. Sometimes we have to take and really make the droplets on outside of the glass so that they stay. I did a Leinenkugel beer one once. All I did was blow in the glass. You know, it's so varied. And sometimes I have to actually do research. I lowered my day rate when I first started working in food styling because we have some food stylists in town that were far more experienced than I, who were charging a lot more. And I also have this thing about waste. I know in many industries, there's a huge waste that comes into play. So I was assisting this stylist once on a fish fry package shot. And she sent me to the store, and this was many, many years ago. She sent me to the store to buy 144 perfect lemons. And I came back and I thought, oh, that's interesting. Maybe they're going to have some sort of prop with it and whatever. It was for one slice. And I don't operate that way. I will not. I just feel like I can make do with what I'm given if, you know, with that, within reason.
What is the trick then? Like when you see commercials of like hamburgers, or I should say cheeseburgers, and you see the cheese that's a perfect triangle, just bent over perfectly coming out of the bun, when, you know, when you make that at home or you buy it, it never looks like that.
Well, I did the last job I did before COVID. I was called by an agency in Chicago called 24/7 who had McDonald's as a client. And at the time, I didn't know what a web influencer was. There is a woman in town who shoots food, promotes food, promotes herself. She eats it. She talks about it. Her Instagram is Hunger Diaries. Well, I was called by the McDonald's and said, they said, you know, we're shooting at so-and-so's home. And are you available? Yes. Well, where's the nearest McDonald's? We're going to order the food for you. And I said, okay. And I told her. And I said, well, you're going to be there, right? The producer, she goes, no, I have a shoot in LA. And I went, okay. She said, you're going to send me pictures of what you're doing and I'll okay it, or I'll tell you where there needs to be more mustard or there needs to be this or that. So that's what we did. I mean, I picked up all this food again, 144 buns for one burger. We did order two burgers, which were already made up as they would sell them. And then I made French fries, and then I got all the FedEx sent all of this, their packaging to me that was going to be featured. And then she set up a table, her camera, and she just did her thing. And then in between shots, I would call Mandy and say, okay, well, there needs to be a little more mustard. Now, in order to melt things, I have this, there's a couple of different ways, but I have this heater that I happened to find from a craft store, which embosses things. So you put heat on it and then whatever bubbles. So if I put heat on it, it doesn't blow air. It will just melt it to whatever consistency I want it to be. So it's little things like that.
Is being a food stylist a good paying job?
Very.
Is there a lot of competition to get into that industry?
When I started, because I started on the film side and not the print side, I was only doing commercials and things. But as time went, and I was called by a lot of out-of-town agencies. Like, I don't know, somehow I got into this where any casino that wanted to feature their restaurants or their chefs was calling me to work on their promotional stuff. But at the time, when I first started, I reached out to some of these more expensive seasoned stylists and said, I would be happy to help you and no charge. You know, I'd be anything you would need. And they never returned phone calls. So when COVID happened, actually even before COVID, when 9/11 happened, and then when 2008 recession happened, budgets were really, really cut. And so food stylists in the film side were going after more print work. And most photographers have their own stylists. They would use, if I were associated with a food photographer, he would consistently call me if he had a shoot and typically make the shoot available or happen when I was available. Since then, you know, occasionally I would get a job for something that stylist wasn't available for Hormel. I did some Hormel stuff. I did, I've done, Line and Kugel, you know, some other offshoot things that they needed a stylist for. But it is very competitive, and especially Minneapolis used to be the most prolific agency area. We had the top agencies and production companies in town. And then that changed as economy changed. And so for me, I did a lot for Northwest Airlines. I did a lot of corporate work for them. I did a lot for Lunds and Byerly's, which is a local, very high-end grocery. Actually also for Super Value Foods, which owns stores all over the country. In fact, right after 9/11, we were shooting in several different stores from here to the East Coast. And rather than fly commercially, we took the Super Value jet, and it was me and the client and my camera guy and the audio guy. And we did 5 cities in 5 days. And it's a good thing we did, because we had 700 pounds of equipment, and there's no way we could have checked it. Mm-hmm. Certainly in Dulles, where we did go, you know, Reagan, we did go there. So, but anyway, you know, things changed a lot. They didn't have $100,000. They weren't putting $100,000 into an in-house video like Super Value did. Or, and then also things changed from film to digital. And so they could get a lot more and create more modules from just the, you know, from a whole bunch of shots. They didn't have to send the film off to Chicago to be processed and then, you know, all of that. So the industry changed.
So for you, do you see this industry changing down the road, or do you think it'll stay the same?
Well, I think it's already, you know, morphing into what it is now. I mean, I think they will shoot less. There's so many shots that you can get these days, people can get on their cameras, on their iPhones. So there are certain instances where they're not going to be using big setups. It just depends on the kind of movement they want. If it's happens to be commercial print, there's so much you can do to manipulate photos and everything now too. So, yeah, it's competitive, and I'm a little concerned. I'd very much like to continue to do food styling. As I mentioned, I was doing temp and food styling at the same time, temp hygiene. And I work in an office that I've been in for years and covered a lot of their other hygiene vacations, medical leaves, and so forth. And so a perfect week was to do a Cub food commercial on Monday and Tuesday and then clean teeth on Wednesday and Thursday. But that isn't happening right now. So like many industries, there are a lot of people who aren't willing to work anymore, or who in certain service, we're having a lot of trouble getting people who will work as a hygienist and, you know, restaurants, the whole thing. So there's a lot of change overall.
We mentioned earlier that you were been on the board of the Minnesota Women in Film and Television. But tell me about women who really cook.
Okay. You did your research. You did. So a friend of mine told me that there was a group in town that had been developed by a very renowned writer, food writer and columnist in the Twin Cities by the name of Sue Zelickson. Sue is 85 or 6 now, I think. And she put together this group about 30 years ago, I guess it is now, of people who work in the food industry. So there are makers. There are one of my friends does dry ingredient recipes and product that you just add the wet ingredients to. Some own restaurants. There's a couple food stylists in the group. There are people who have food trucks. I mean, there are all these women that work in the industry. And so actually years ago, you get up at the meeting and you talk about what your needs might be as an employer or what you're doing and so forth. And I said to Sue, I think it would be fun to put something together between Minnesota Women in Film and Women Who Really Cook. And she goes, why don't you shoot a video for us? So we went into this beautiful restaurant and we shot our meeting there, the Women Who Really Cook meeting, where and food was provided and people go around. And so we did a video of that. Now, they did another one last year out on a pizza farm in the country where people just bring their chairs and order pizza and sit out and listen to music and so forth. So they've done another one since then. But I've just met some wonderful people there. I unfortunately was hoping that I would generate some work through that. But that's kind of a fallacy when you join groups like MnWIFT or Women Who Really Cook or so forth. We are networking groups, but a lot of people come in thinking they're there to find people to get a job with. And it isn't so much that.
I think most of those business networking groups, it's hard to get business through them. It's more of just a gathering more than anything else.
Well, in film and television, you know, usually if you meet somebody who's a producer and they're doing a particular kind of project, they will bring in their friends. But food stylists, most of the people that I interfaced with in both groups were not looking for that particular genre.
Vintage jewelry. You repurpose and design unique pieces. You said that you're creative. Is this something, Jody, that started where you did a couple pieces for yourself and people said, hey, where did you get that? And then pretty soon you're making it for friends and now you've turned it into a small business?
Well, I'm wearing one.
Wow, that's nice.
Thank you. This started out, well, so how it started was my mother, who had amazing, beautiful jewelry, had gotten a piece where her wrist being so small, she took a little piece off of it and she gave it to me. She said, you know, you could do something with this. And I thought, oh, I could put it on a chain or I could make a chain. And that's how it started. So it was in the maybe late 80s, maybe. And then I really became kind of infatuated with older pieces. So I took old and new pieces and combine them to redesign for people who said, oh, I have this necklace and I bought it and I don't like it. Can you redesign it? And I've done that. And I've also just created with pieces I've collected around the world. But this one in particular, I decided to make a charm necklace of shoes. And so I collected all these sterling charms of shoes and in the meantime, collected some really cool other vintage charms and other charms. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to make the whole thing charms that mean something to me. I will make this. I can be commissioned to do this. This is not for sale, but I thought thematically, if somebody were say, you know, a musician and they wanted a bunch of charms that represented music or anything. But this is only one example. I mean, some of the other things I've done, I tend to use a lot of pearls and I use majority sterling, but some of the vintage brass and gold is just amazing to work with. So I have sold in some stores a long time ago. I have been in the process of trying to get my website up on Etsy and I just haven't gotten there. And I have so much material to work with that I probably could sit here for the rest of my life and never use it all. Same with knitting. I'm a knitter too.
Now that we probably got some listeners interested in that, where can they connect mm-hmm. with you? Tell them what social media and what your website is.
Well, my website is jodylichtor.com, jodylichtor.com. It's still in process. Unfortunately, the designer who did it for me, when I asked to add more things to it, she said the platform no longer supported that. So she had to recreate the whole thing for me last year with a little bit different look. And I still have to add some photos to that. That's probably the best place to get in touch with me or email me at jodylichtor@gmail.com. That is my website for my other ventures.
What I'll do, listeners, is I'll put a link to her website and also a link to her email address. So you can just click on it and either email her or go right to her website. Last thing, Jody, before we wrap up, what's upcoming for you? Anything new and exciting that you want to talk about?
Well, I'm looking to move to Europe.
Wow. That's exciting.
Part time. That's been kind of my vision. I'd like to find a house. I also write. So I have a couple books that anything else, but I saw on CNN and advertising articles, I should say, they weren't advertising, talking about in Italy in particular, but there are other countries that do this, wanting to repopulate their smaller communities where people have left homes in various disarray. So they're selling the homes for as low as a euro. And then you have 2 years to renovate with the help of them and some monies and some of their workmen. They also have a number of homes that are for sale in a lesser, in lower prices, maybe 12, 15, 18, 40,000, 50,000 that are affordable too. And so I initially was going to do this. And then I thought, I can't do this by myself and be here and do it. So I'm exploring other options. I also started taking French from two French guys online, and they teach French to people from all over the world. They're called AT Frenchies. I started that for a year. I started French in the third grade, and I quit in junior high for the same reason I'm struggling now, which is I have trouble with the verbs. But I thought I might as well, instead of learning Italian, which I know a teeny, teeny bit, to just proceed with that and just see, they help expats come over there too. That's part of the thing. Another thing I'm doing is I'm trying to connect with a company, or I have connected with a company out in Amsterdam. These two women were sitting on the canal and drinking soda, and the straw kept raising to the top of the glass. It kept rising. And they realized they had something. So they developed this thing. It's called I get the name kind of backwards, but it's called the Great Bubble Barrier. And they developed this piece of equipment that when you put in the canals, forces plastic into a corral and they can extract it. So I want to bring them here to the Twins, to Minnesota, because of all our lakes, but they aren't going into the United States at this point. So I'm trying to put together a committee of people and get a sponsor to do that here too.
Well, Jody, thank you so much for your time and coming on the show and talking about all this.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It was my pleasure.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. My listeners, and especially me, I love food. I'm a foodie, but learning more about food stylists and stuff, I think is intriguing. And you've kind of given us a little glimpse into that world. So I appreciate, I'm sure my listeners do as well. And I wish you nothing but success. And I hope the whole thing in Europe works out for you. And who knows what you might end up doing.
Well, thank you, Tommy.
You bet. Thank you. Listeners, before we go, join the exclusive Before the Lights members group. Click the link in the show notes. It includes private video calls with former guests, a one-of-a-kind collector's poker chip, I do extra content, and more. It's a small way for you to support the show. It costs you hardly anything. It's only $7.99 a month, and we have a great time on the Zoom calls as well. That's going to do it for this episode of Before the Lights. I'm Tommy Canale, and until next time, everybody, I salute. A chin chin.